This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
More information can be found at kboo.fm/dreams2013.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies, where you can explore how media in all forms affect not only how we view the world, but how we shape it. You'll learn the power of media and how you can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications. Details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO.
It's 9:04 in Cascadia. This is Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, the Pope is out of here. From the New York Times, Pope Benedict the 16th, left the Vatican by helicopter, shades of triumph of the will. In the afternoon, local time, arriving at the papal summer residence in the final hours of his nearly eight-year scandal-dogged papacy, onlookers in St. Peter's Square cheered and Romans stood on rooftops to wave flags as he flew by. His retirement formally takes effect at 8 p.m. local time, 3 hours after his departure, when he will become the Pope Emeritus. Earlier in one of his concluding acts, he addressed the cardinals who will elect his successor, urging them to be like an orchestra that harmonizes for the good of the Roman Catholic Church and pledging that he would behave with unconditional reverence and obedience towards his successor. After thanking the more than 100 cardinals collectively from a gilded throne in the Clementine Hall of the Apostolic Palace, the Pope rose and greeted each of them individually. And he says, departing from the text, that he is just a pilgrim now, and I have another word for that. Fugitive comes to mind, and I suppose that Cardinal Darth Laveda, who Oregonians will remember, fled to the Vatican or was plucked in order to avoid pedophilia charges. Must have been one of those greeting him. More on that in a minute. More headlines from Radio Havana, Cuba. The military judge overseeing the trial of alleged U.S. Army whistleblower Bradley Manning has ruled his right to a speedy trial has not been violated, despite more than 1,000 days behind bars. Manning's attorneys had accused prosecutors of extreme foot-dragging, but Judge Colonel Denise Lynn rejected the argument, saying prosecutors have initiated excludable delays. The ruling appears to end the last of Manning's options to have his case dismissed before a full court-martial is scheduled to begin in June. And more on that from Russia Today. Bradley Manning, the U.S. Army intelligence officer accused of passing sensitive military documents to whistleblowing website WikiLeaks, is expected to tell a courtroom Thursday morning why he assisted in the leak. And that's this morning. So I suppose that's going on. And returning to the text, Private First Class Bradley Manning, 25, is scheduled to make a statement today, his second since being arrested in May 2010 on suspicion of giving Julian Assange's website hundreds of thousands of U.S. State Department diplomatic cables and a trove of other documents. Manning is slated to go before a military court-martial this June and faces life imprisonment if convicted of aiding the enemy, the most serious of the charges against him. On Thursday, however, the Kansas-born soldier is expected to plead guilty on lesser charges in hopes of a more lenient sentence, and in doing so, he may speak about his motivation for leaking the files. Also from Russia Today, Manning is expected to publicly explain his reasons for releasing classified information through WikiLeaks. That's what the Bradley Manning Support Network says. And quoting Julian Assange, if Bradley Manning did as he is accused, he is a hero and invaluable to all of us. That's Assange said that in December. It was WikiLeaks revelations, he said, not the actions of President Obama that forced the U.S. administration out of the Iraq war by exposing the killing of Iraqi children. WikiLeaks directly motivated the Iraqi government to strip the U.S. military of legal immunity, which in turn forced the U.S. withdrawal. Okay, and returning to the abdication, this from gaystarnews.com. The African cardinal, widely tipped to be the next pope, has blamed the Catholic Church's pedophilia on gay priests. Cardinal Peter Turkson from Ghana said the sex abuses would never happen in Africa because the culture is against homosexuality. Speaking to CNN, the 64-year-old said African traditional systems kind of protect or have protected its population against the tendency. Because, he said, in several communities and several cultures in Africa, homosexuality, or for that matter any affair between two sexes of the same kind, are not countenanced in our society. So that cultural taboo, that tradition has been there, Turkson said. It has served to keep it out. In response, the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales issued a statement slamming Cardinal's views, saying there is no empirical data which concludes that sexual orientation is connected to child sexual abuse. Turkson, who is also president of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, is one of the top favorites to take over from Pope Benny XVI, who announced his shock resignation on the 11th of February. In the past, the cardinal has also said many of the laws imposed on gay people in Africa are an exaggeration. This is Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Number to call with your comments, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Paul Bouchet has reported in alternet.org that only 3% of the very rich are entrepreneurs. According to both MarketWatch and economist Edward Wolf, over 90% of the assets owned by millionaires are held in a combination of low-risk investments, bonds and cash, personal business accounts, stock market, and the real estate. Only 3.6% of taxpayers in the top 0.1% are classified as entrepreneurs based on a 2004 tax returns. Now, departing from that information, well, let's put it another way. If you hear that the very rich are very rich because they're brilliant and entrepreneurs, you're 97% wrong. And another statistic that I've read, it's been a few years, and I don't remember the provenance of it, but I'm pretty sure it's correct, is that about 70% of people in the top point tiny amount of the very rich inherited it. For example, the Walton family, who get the billions from the hard work, the sweat, blood, and tears of Walmart workers. Returning to the text from that article by Paul Bouchet in Alternet, which is a very good website. You should turn to that, alternet.org. Check it out. Something good every day. Number two, only 4 out of 150 countries have more wealth inequality than us, than the U.S. In a world listing compiled by a reputable research team, the U.S. has greater wealth inequality than every measured country in the world, except for Namibia, Zimbabwe, Denmark, and Switzerland. Excuse me. And that is simply incorrect. Okay, I'll take that back. Let's just say the U.S. has greater wealth inequality than every measured country in the world. There we go. An amount equal to one-half the GDP is held untaxed overseas by rich Americans. The Tax Justice Network estimated that between $21 and $32 trillion is hidden offshore untaxed, with Americans making up 40% of the world's ultra-high-net-worth individuals. That's $8 to $12 trillion in U.S. money stashed in far-off hiding places. Based on a historical stock market return of 6%, up to $750 billion of income is lost to the U.S. every year, resulting in a tax loss of about $260 billion. And I bring this information out because, well, for example, my union buddies driving the buses here in Portland, Oregon, are being set upon by people who are saying that they're being paid too much. People, we don't have a problem with working people getting paid too much. We'll never, ever turn the economy around by busting working people. No, We need to bust these tax dodgers. And I would argue that those trillions that are hidden offshore, if they are correct, $32 trillion, Tax Justice Network says that, shouldn't be just taxed. It should be seized. The hell with them. They're hiding their money so they can screw the society. It's criminal. Let's take it. We have warships, don't we? And fourth on a list of 10, corporations stopped paying half their taxes after the recession. After paying an average of 22.5% from 87 to 2008, corporations have paid an annual rate of 10% since. This represents a sudden $250 billion annual loss in taxes. So returning to what I was saying, it ain't the working class that has caused the problem. It ain't the working class money that can solve the problem. Only taxing and seizing the stolen assets of the super rich will solve the U.S. economic problems. And when you really look at it, the U.S. doesn't actually have an economic problem. Nope, it's not real. We don't have an economic problem. What we have is a problem that we allow the very, very rich to destroy the economy day after day, year after year. Why? Why do we lick their boots? Number five on a list of 10, just 10 Americans made a total of $50 billion in 1 year. Number six on a list of 10, tax deductions for the rich could pay off 100% of the deficit. That's based on research by Tax Policy Center. Tax deferrals and deductions and other forms of tax expenditures, which largely benefit the rich, are worth about 7.4% of the gross domestic product, about $1.1 trillion. Could just pay it right off. No problem. Once again, the problem is the rich. Number seven, the average single black or Hispanic woman has about $100 in net worth. And departing from this text, here's a statistic to remember. And rather than give you a website on this, I encourage you just to research this. It won't take you long. Use a web search engine and look this up. What percentage of U.S. wealth is held by the bottom 50%? Want to guess? They can get it within 5%, maybe 10%. What percentage of the wealth of the U.S. population is held by the bottom 50%? So I'll give it away. You ready for this? Less than 2%. Can that be true? Oh, yes. That's how rich the very rich are. Why are we beating up the working class? Why are we beating up ourselves? Why? Why? Number to call, 503-231-8187. And Jack is on the phone.
Yeah, in answer to your question, I would say why? Because there's so many wedge issues that are dividing the underclasses. They're just fighting amongst themselves over things that... Well, unfortunately, they just divide them.
Right on. Jim Hightower defines that as the rich's tactic of let's you and him fight.
Yep, right. And I recommend, and I wish I'd hear it more on KBOO from any of the morning talk people, Wall Street sales tax. Modest. It could be small. It could be, it is being floated. 1% is the number that's most often heard.
Yeah, 1% on the tax on the transactions. I mean, that would have the dual effect. I know that you're about to say this, right? It would have a dual effect. Not only would it bring in the billions that we need, it would have an effect on the stock market. They would stop these microsecond trades that they do with computers, these weird, you know, thousands of times per second microsecond trades.
Right. Those trades are there's at zero productivity in that process. That's pure gambling.
Yep.
And it's insanity, and it that would be a huge step toward dealing with it. But curiously, and there is a burgeoning movement. Anybody can look that up. Wall Street sales tax. Google that, and there's a lot on it. Curiously, the left is slow in the take up on this.
I think we just need information on that. I think that's, you know, that's one reason why I do the news. You're not supposed to know, because we just need to get the word out. So,
okay,
thanks for bringing
that
up. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Young adults have lost 2/3 of their net worth since 1984, and the American public has paid about $4 trillion to bail out the banks. Did you know all that? Did you know that there's $1 quadrillion in securities trading nets, zero tax revenue for the U.S.? Yep. Why are we feeding the rich? And then saying that, oh my gosh, we don't have money, we need sequestration. We need sequestration. All right, number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Coming up, at 9:30. Stay tuned for Linda Olsen Osterlund. She'll be talking about the drones that are being produced and flown around right here in Portland. And I was thinking about that the other morning because I realized I was sitting at home and I could hear this, you know, something in my mind's ear. I told myself, "Oh, that's just," in my mind's eye. I said, "Well, that's just a Cessna going circling over and over and over." And you know, day after day after day, heavy cloud cover, I can hear this single engine prop going around. And it finally occurred to me, there's no way that's one person in an aircraft. They get bored senseless. That's a drone. And you're going to have the details at 9:30. Linda Olsen Osterlund, stay tuned for that. And changing topics just a little bit, we'll talk about the climate emergency. I'm going to be emphasizing this for quite a while because it is quite an emergency. Human CO2 releases are about 35 gigatons annually. If you look at the USGS website about volcanoes, you'll find that that old conservative look the other way canard about volcanoes producing more CO2 than humans, very, very untrue. And that's the hard science. Sorry, guys. So over 20 years, that's 700 gigatons at the present rate. Now compare that evidence from... Now that is creating the climate crisis and is pushing us past a tipping point so that methane is now bursting out of the Arctic. I've talked about that in more detail in previous shows. Talking about the methane and clathrate gun. Evidence from Siberian caves suggests that a global temperature rise of 1.5 degrees Celsius could see permanently frozen ground thaw over a large area of Siberia, excuse me, threatening release of carbon from soils and damage to natural and human environments. A thaw in Siberia's permafrost, ground frozen throughout the year, could release over 1,000 gigatons. Now remember, I was talking about 700 gigatons over a decade, human-induced. 1,000 gigatons of the greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, and methane into the atmosphere, accelerating global warming. Now remember, methane is like 25% as effective, 25 times as effective as carbon dioxide in trapping heat. So I speculate if half the Siberian carbon methane released over the 20 years, 500 gigatons, and add the rest of the Arctic, including the subsurface releases measured now even in January that I talked about last week, I could imagine Arctic releases exceeding human. And the only reason I bring that up is because that's how big the methane trigger is in the Arctic. And that is happening now because there are tundra fires going on. And I have some more information on tundra fires, I think. Ah, here we are. Wildfires in Alaska have become more widespread over the past 50 years, according to scientists in the U.S. Now, the reason I'm bringing up these tundra fires is because all of the modeling that has been done has not taken into the fact that when this methane is released, it can simply burn. And that's another thing that you can use a web search to find on the web. It will astonish you. You can poke a hole in the ice in certain places in Alaska and hold the lighter to it, and you will get a flame. And it's just astonishing to see that done. When this methane is released, if it's released as a clathrate, it can burst into flames. And it can burst into flames without you standing there with a lighter as well. And this evidently is starting to happen. Returning to the article, fires are well known to impact the climate by releasing sequestered carbon into the atmosphere. Now, I think it's funny that here's a different use of the word sequestered. So I want to explain what it means. It means set aside. When you talk about sequestration, economically, you're talking about that percentage that has been set aside to be reduced from the complete budget. So don't be afraid of that word. Set aside, sequestration, set aside, that's all it means. And when you're talking about sequestered carbon, we're talking about carbon that's been set aside and remains in the tundra or under the sea or wherever it is locked up, for example, in clathrates. So, as I said, fires are well known to impact the climate by releasing sequestered, set-aside carbon into the atmosphere. As the climate warms, scientists expect the number of wildfires to grow, and as a result, more carbon to be released. Wildfires are normally associated with hot regions, such as Southeast Asia or Southern Africa, and occasionally with colder forested regions. In recent years, however, the occurrence of wildfires in cold regions, even without forests, has changed scientists' outlook. In 2007, for example, a fire around the Anaktuvuk River, easy for someone else to say, on Alaska's North Slope, burned 1,000 square kilometers of tundra. That doubled in one event the cumulative area burned in the region over the previous 50 years. And in 2010, the Noatak tundra region in northwest Alaska saw 37 fires and the burning of 440 square kilometers. Tundra fires are important because they have the potential to switch regions from being climate cooling, thanks to their reflective white surface, to climate warming. With this in mind, Adrian Rocha at the University of Notre Dame, U.S., and colleagues have sought to estimate how the carbon footprint of Alaskan wildfires has changed over the past century. Rocha's group was able to assess how the size of tundra fires has altered over time using data held at the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. The researchers found that there has been a general increase in the area burnt by wildfires in the north of Alaska. Then, using additional satellite data, they tracked how these fires had affected the region's reflectivity and vegetation or greenness over time. They discovered that the wildfires scorched the ground initially, but over a decade or more led to more vegetation than there had been before. However, this research has also found a long-term increase in the depth of soil that thawed every summer. And that's significant because when you're trying to estimate the chance of the clathrate gun, in other words, such a sudden and massive release of methane from various sources in the Arctic that global warming increases vastly over a period of a couple or a few years, you have to take these fires into effect, and it's too soon. Science being conservative and research being based on money being available, there simply hasn't been time to conduct studies. And so that brings me to what I feel is my duty, doing the news you're not supposed to know. And I want to bring up something that I've pounded on for years now, namely that there is quite an acceleration in the acceleration. These reports, these projections, these estimates, if one could graph them, one would see that the damage that is happening and the damage that is projected is ascending exponentially. And so I see it as my part, as someone who looks at the news and does the news you're not supposed to know, to say something that the scientists want, which is there is an many scientists are now saying this, there is an extreme danger of this this catastrophe accelerating beyond our capacity to even imagine in our lifetime. This comes in the footsteps of the melting of half the Arctic, and as I reported last week, the removal of 80% thinning of the Arctic ice cap ice. This is an extreme emergency. This is the emergency of our time. We are already seeing it with Storm Nemo, Storm Sandy, Storm this, Storm that. And this is only going to increase. So, and rather than go to the, I will go to what I feel the collective mind must now go to, which is we have to take emergency measures, measures that just a few years ago I would have denounced as stupid because they would have encouraged the continued burning of carbon. Politically, I think that we cannot expect a political change with the tools and methods and the establishment that we now have swiftly enough to begin to sharply reduce carbon production. And even if we did, we would still be faced with this emergency, a sudden release of carbon and methane that will warm the earth, that will, I suppose, aside from the many effects, loss of forests, rising of the sea level, all that sort of thing, those seem a little abstract, don't they? You can't grow food if the climate isn't stable. We'll all starve to death. That's what we need to focus on. That's how extreme the emergency is. We're talking about mass death. Kind of takes away that whole, gosh, the population's getting too big problem, doesn't it? And, you know, and old fat and, not sufficiently generalized people like me will be the first to go. So I'm glad that I've had a good life, but this is the emergency that faces us. And I feel after looking at the methane situation and the melting of the ice cap, I feel like that I cannot exaggerate this. And we take, a society takes many preventative measures, many ensuring measures for threats that may or may not materialize. For example, we have troops all over Europe on the outside chance that the what's left of the Soviet Empire is going to invade. How likely is that? But I'll tell you, those troops and those billions of dollars and those tanks and those missiles are all out there because it's just in case. Well, what are we doing about this extreme climate emergency? And what should we be doing? And go to the phones just real quickly. I think I have time just for one call. And so, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. That plane that you were talking about, I first noticed it about at least 4 years ago, and I told you guys about it about 2 years ago. And I'm glad to see you guys are finally jumping right on top of that.
Yeah, well, you told us so credits.
My neighbor around the corner from me as a private pilot instructor, and summer before last, he called the FAA because he saw the plane on a nice, clear, sunny day flying around in circles. He thought the pilot had a stroke, so he called the FAA, and by the time he finally got to about the third or fourth person, they finally told him it was a law enforcement plane. But I said, what kind of law enforcement plane is it? And he said that he didn't know, but this is a guy who was a cop for about a month.
Well, stay tuned, because we've got a whole program coming up on that from the excellent.
And also, speaking of sneaky things, keep an eye out, because you'll that little Dodge Omni parked next to you or driving around like a nondescript type of a car, that may be an undercover police officer. They're all over the place. So, anyway.
Okay, thanks for the tip.
Anyway, take care. Bye-bye.
All right, the time is 9:28 here in Cascadia, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up, more of the incomparable radio zine, so stay tuned.
Fusion creates events that celebrate different modalities of expression and community building. Friday, March 1st, KBOO Radio is proud to help PDX Fusion in sponsoring a night themed around dreams at the Refuge, 116 Southeast Yamhill. The night begins with a lecture entitled The Art of Dreaming, which will include visual representations of dream theory, demonstrate practical work in our relationships, as well as give the audience a brief opportunity to explore inner work. That's Fusion Dreams at 116 Southeast Yamhill. This is a 21 and over event on Friday, March 1st at 8 p.m. More information can be found at kbu.fm/dreams2013.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Benz Les Schwab Amphitheater, presenting alternative rock band Cake and Icelandic rock band Sigur Rós over Memorial Day weekend. Cake and Sigur Rós tickets are available Friday at bendconcerts.com.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to A Deeper Look. I'm your host, Linda Olson-Osterlund. Our topic today is unmanned aerial vehicles, otherwise known as drones, their use in the world, in Oregon, and upcoming April Days of Action, a political uprising to stop drone spying and killing. My guest is Deborah Sweet, a lifelong activist. She's the director of the organization The World Can't Wait and part of the Network for Stopping Drone Spying and Warfare. Welcome to KBOO, Deborah.
Thank you, Linda. It's great to be here with you.
Yeah, I see your emails all the time, and I know you see mine, so it's really nice to have the voice there.
Yeah.
And thank you for joining us. I know you've had a busy week of activism.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm just coming over the news as the report from Fort Meade, the hearings on Bradley Manning's case, which I'm just finding really, really disturbing. That here he has accepted responsibility for 10 of the charges against him and agreed to serve 20 years in prison, but he's still going to have to go to trial for the more serious charges of espionage and aiding the enemy.
Well, I think it's another case of where people are going to have to be involved in as activists to help make sure that Bradley Manning doesn't end up in prison for a really long time. There was good news about longtime prisoners, though, today. I just want to remind people, if they didn't see it, they can go to Democracy Now!, that one of the Angola Three has once again been cleared by a court. And so there is the possibility of a release coming up pretty quick. Well, let's get to our topic today. It's drones. And the use of
drones for killing by the Obama administration has been in the news a lot recently. First in the leaking of the so-called white paper dealing with targeted assassinations, and then in the statements of a former Obama press secretary, Robert Gibbs, during an MSNBC interview. Can you talk about these recent revelations? I know you covered them on your website.
Well, first of all, it's really good this is coming out because the Obama administration, from the very first days Barack Obama was in office in early 2009, began not only a campaign of the use of drones in Pakistan and Yemen that we know some things about, but developed much more extensively than the Bush regime had ever done a policy of targeted killing. And we've been trying to find out what happens on these so-called Terror Tuesdays when we're told that every other Tuesday Obama meets with his national security team and signs the death warrants for people known and unknown who are going to be targeted by drone strikes all across the region and, as far as we know, in possibly seven or eight countries. With more and more drone bases.
Right, and I think that's really important to point out. For those who doubt that this is the new form of U.S. military and its way of dominating the world, you need to look at how many drone bases are being built. I think a lot of Hillary Clinton's job that she finished just fine for Obama was in helping lay the groundwork for this. I know that we're suing one base in Saudi Arabia to try to force them to become our drone base there. And I read that we sent 50 more troops to Niger to join 40 others there because, excuse me, we now have an agreement for a drone base in Niger. This is definitely the use of unmanned aerial vehicles to surveil and to kill and dominate other populations is definitely the agenda of our military right now.
Yeah, well, I think what you're describing is a change.
Yes.
From the Bush regime sending aircraft carriers, B-1 bombers, and huge numbers of, you know, what they call